I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. You're an engaged and caring citizen of whatever Vermont town or city you live in, so much so that the first Tuesday in March is your Super Bowl. You go to your local town meeting, you take the mic to have your say on local issues, and you vote, sometimes for change. And maybe that change gets approved. You and your neighbors have taken the time to gather information, listen to debate, and ultimately cast ballots to have a say in the way things are run at the grassroots level. So it's direct democracy in action, right? Well, not so fast. That charter change does not get a green light until lawmakers in Montpelier say so. And a lot of times they don't, putting the brakes on that idea of direct democracy. Today, we're going to explore why that extra approval is required in Montpelier, and we have a number of guests with direct experience in these issues. Joining us today from our studios in Montpelier is Susan Clark, an educator and co-author of the book Slow Democracy, Rediscovering Community, Bringing Decision-Making Back. She's also a town moderator in her home of Middlesex. Susan Clark, thanks so much for being with us today.
Glad to be here.
Also in Montpelier is Karen Horn, Director of Public Policy for the Vermont League of Cities and Towns. She is also active in her local government and school board in Moortown. Karen, thank you so much for the time today.
Glad to be here.
Well, Susan Clark, let me start with you. You've written in Slow Democracy about kind of two Vermonts, essentially, that shape our perceptions and our practices of local control. What do you mean by the terms uphillers and somewheres, and what do those groups represent when it comes to governance?
Yeah, fascinating topic, really. Paul Searles is a historian in Vermont who wrote about two Vermonts recently in recent years, and he talked about the uphillers and the downhillers. The uphillers being the folks who originally lived on hill farms, they tend to have values that are local and cooperative. They value self-reliance and independence, and whereas the downhillers are the folks who are the sort of more village-dwelling professionals. More likely to be in concentrated populations near the mills. He was looking at the period between, the Industrial Revolution, 1865 to 1910. But we see these values today. We're not really talking about geographic or education or economic factors. These are ideology. They're temperament. And they add up to a question of identity. And so you mentioned the somewheres and the anywheres. It's another way of describing this. A wonderful book by David Goodhart, The Road to Somewhere. And anywhere is a person who's accumulated enough formal education and career success that they can live anywhere. So they have an achieved identity. It's portable. They tend to be sort of the cosmopolitan elite, whereas the somewheres, who still exist in vast numbers today across – he's writing about England, but it's across the United States and certainly in Vermont. These are folks who tend to, ascribe their identity to a particular place, or a group, and they again value self-reliance and egalitarianism, they have this sense of place that is critical to their identity. They aren't going away. It's not an old way of being that is going to change. Somewheres don't suddenly become anywheres as things change. They're based on basic human temperament.
I mean, the stuff you're talking about is so familiar to anybody who has, had some friction with folks who have lived here for generations and then those that are, often called flatlanders, people from away, and are they moving in to sort of usurp the traditional values of Vermont? This sounds like a really old debate that's still going on today.
Well, downhillers and anywhere share a lot of traits, but one of them stands out, which is they tend to think that what's good for them must be good for everyone. So they tend to impose their values on their counterparts. And so really that's the tension, is how can we value both of these sets of traits and identities and create, that's what democracy is, right? It's a system where we can respect, multiple values. And, one of those is local decision making. It's a way to kind of spread out some of that tension.
Karen Horn, I want to talk about the rules and regulations, if you will, why these charter changes I talked about at the top have to go through Montpelier first. And this has to do with something called Dillon's Rule here in Vermont, and that's spelled D-I-L-L-O-N, not like Bob Dylan and not any relation, I believe, to our BPR reporter John Dillon either. But what is Dillon's rule? And, you know, what kind of sway does it have here in Vermont?
So Dillon's rule is a policy, really, that was instituted in the late 1800s because of a decision made by an Iowa Supreme Court justice, Justice Dillon.
Sorry, I put that in your
head. Excuse him. Yes.
They are a change.
Yeah. And really what it says is that a municipality may only do those things that the legislature gives them specific permission to do. And that is the law in the state of Vermont. Across the country, you have a wide spectrum of states that allow towns to do the things they think are appropriate in their communities unless the legislature says no, which would be a home rule state, all the way to Vermont, who is in good company with places like Alabama in this respect, that you can only do those things that the legislature specifically says you may do. So
that's an interesting distinction, because what you're saying is home rule, which I think is a phrase a lot of people are familiar with. That's something where the legislature can step in, and if they disagree with something and say, no, you can't do that. But here with Dillon's rule, you've got to run it by the legislature first at all to get approval.
Yes, that's right.
That's the main difference.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a look at some places where local voting ended up going for naught after a review in Montpelier. There was a 0.5% tax on rental cars. This was passed by the Burlington City Council to help pay for road repair and emergency services
in South Burlington.
In and around South Burlington. I should know that. It's my own stomping grounds. You know, not surprisingly, car rental companies opposed this tax hike in South Burlington. But the voters on town meeting day, they said yes, rather decisively. Susan Clark, without getting into the back and forth on whether the tax was a good idea, isn't this kind of morale busting as an outcome for both voters in South Burlington and the city council members who approved that tax?
Yes, and we see it in multiple issues. We've certainly seen it in Act 46, where communities have, you know, been asked to vote on a thing and then been overridden. We see it in town meeting. People really do want that actual power. They aren't really interested in just being advisors, except for town size. Issues and being able to meaningfully take a stand on issues are the single most important factor in town meeting attendance. So if you take that to the larger level and say, what makes us citizens? What makes me want to participate in democracy and not just stay home? This kind of, being heard and having a meaningful impact has a huge impact on how, you know, our local democracy can actually feed the meaning of a larger democratic republic.
We are speaking about local control or the lack thereof, and we're speaking with Karen Horn and Susan Clark, our guests today. And if you have an opinion on this, and I'm sure that you do, give us a call at 800-639-2211, 800-639-2211, as we dig into these issues of who should get to say what about local laws and governance. Let's go to the phones. We've got Nicholas on the line from Glover. Hi, Nicholas. You're on the air.
Hi. Hello, Karen and Susan. As you both know, I'm town moderator in Glover, and I'm fully in accord with the idea that the legislature ought to yield their control of this issue. What I'm most concerned about is that the declining attendance in town meeting and the use of the Australian ballot has really lowered participation in our meeting. And although some people don't think at the end of the meeting when we have discussions under other business that's not so important, I find that is when the issues that affect the whole state come out. And I would hate to lose that opportunity. And you'll find very often that the legislators pick up on the strong declaration of opinion you hear under other business, and they often convert that into interesting legislation.
Nicholas, I want to have both Karen and Susan respond to you in a moment, but I want to ask you first, when you talk about Australian ballot, we should let folks know that's the secret balloting where you write your vote down. Nobody gets to see what it is. That's what you're talking about?
I am. It's not – the secrecy is not the issue, really. It's the issue that you can't raise issues from the floor and vote on them in those towns that have Australian ballot for the budget items and other items. There are some minor issues that can be raised, but the really important issues can't be discussed on the floor. Mm. So most of the people in my meeting, I think, they're happy to stand up and declare their interest on an article and raise their hand and so forth. It's not the secrecy that's the issue.
It's just hashing it out and having that say. Susan, you want to take that one first in discussing what Nicholas is talking about here? Is this the kind of thing that you're seeing as well locally?
Sure. I mean, I do think, and I think what Nicholas is talking about, Australian ballot is the pre-printed ballot. It's how we vote for president, whereas you can actually have a secret ballot at a town meeting. It's called a paper ballot. So secrecy is absolutely allowed at town meeting, and people do exercise that on issues that they feel are important. But this idea of making decisions at the local level is really in keeping with, modern democratic sensibilities, and I think that's what Nicholas is talking about. Oftentimes at town meeting we'll be asked questions of national import. Our expectations about citizenship have changed since the internet, and today's citizens, millennials, any generation who grew up with the internet, they're accustomed to self-organizing. They expect to be asked. They expect to be included in decisions. They prefer flat, non-hierarchical systems. And so in a sense, this 200, 300-year-old tradition of town meeting is enormously modern in terms of what people how people want to engage today.
Karen Horn, let me ask you, what is your sense on whether there is a groundswell to change this practice of running charter change votes by Montpelier? Are you hearing from people just anecdotally that they're kind of sick of this and they want more local control?
Well, it's not a new issue. We've been We, the League of Cities and Towns, has been supportive of local control. As one of our board members said in the year 2000, since about the time water was invented. And if I may, I have my favorite quote from a local official is that in a society in where people are becoming increasingly alienated from the political process, local government remains the most realistic opportunity for participation, but you can't create that if a city has no power. Hmm. And that was said by then Mayor Bernie Sanders in 1987. So the issue is not new. What seems to be new is a willingness on at least the Senate side in the legislature to really look at maybe a new way of addressing local issues and getting towns the authority they need to make decisions on the local level.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that about the Senate, because as I understand it, there is a proposal, a bill that's in front of the Senate. It won't get acted on in time for this legislative session, but this is a proposal to come up with something different about these charter changes. What can you tell us about this proposed bill?
Yeah, so it's S-106, and it actually passed the Senate on a vote of 21-8, and it's in the House Government Operations Committee now, where it's been since the middle of April. It would set up a system where there's a commission, a municipal self-governance commission outside of the legislature, and a municipality, could put proposals before their voters, have them adopted by the voters to enact certain authorities via ordinances, and then they would take that proposal to the Self-Governance Commission. They would have the conversation there about what's the best way to enact those proposals, how might they work best, and then they, if approved, those municipalities could then go out and actually enact the authorities, the ordinances that they had proposed. It's not restricted to just towns with charters, and that's important because there's about 58 towns with charters in the state, and we have 246 cities and towns, so a lot of places don't have governance charters.
Right.
This is a pilot. It would allow up to ten towns to bring their proposals forward, and the pilot would be for 5 years. So we were really hoping it would open up the conversation and create a different dynamic where you could actually look at results and see what works best and where innovations are working at the local level, and then move ahead from there.
You know what I think
Go ahead, Susan.
Oh, I was just going to say, what's really exciting for me about this kind of concept is that we hear a lot about we certainly have, since the Industrial Revolution, been hearing a lot about the advantages of centralization, efficiency, and it's faster, and the solutions are based on experts, and easier for management, and uniformity, and predictability. Whereas the pluses of local control, we don't sing them as often. But what we see with these kind of local decisions is that these decisions are more durable because we have better buy-in, and so we have less pushback, and we build trust. We build customized solutions that are, you know, framed on local wisdom and local values. And importantly, we're also training local leadership skills so that we are better prepared in crises and emergencies. People can step up. They know what leadership looks like. They know what organizing looks like. And we can really have a mosaic of diverse views rather than sort of uniform ones. So I think it's a terrific way to sort of reconcile the freedom and unity motto of Vermont with bringing some of these decisions closer to the people who they affect.
And joining us now on the line is Brattleboro Town Manager Peter Elwell, who's something of an expert in municipal management, having worked in cities in Florida, New Jersey, and now in Vermont. Peter Elwell, welcome to Vermont Edition. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Mitch.
Is there a too much authority in your mind in Montpelier to make decisions on what has been decided at a very local level?
We feel constrained not only by the types of things that you've already described, where, you know, a charter might be changed or some other larger action is being considered, but even on some of the very basic, most local decisions, like on-street parking regulations and how local fees are collected in the local administrative offices. There's some really basic municipal functions that are directed by the state in ways that we think are make government not only less responsive in problem solving, but just less efficient in daily operations.
Now, it seems like there are two main issues you're talking about with this Montpelier influence. You've kind of touched on them a little bit. One has to do with collecting money, essentially, and the other is kind of a time problem. I mean, can you flesh out those issues a little bit?
Absolutely. So the money one is huge because since municipalities in Vermont are only allowed to do the things that we're explicitly permitted to do, we're extremely constrained in the ways in which we can raise revenue. And so Brattleboro, for instance, is 85% of our revenue for our town operations comes from the property tax. And that's really typical around the state. There are communities that actually depend even more upon the property tax than we do. And so that's a tremendous burden to the local folks who would prefer to see a more diverse set of revenues with less pressure on people who, for instance, have been on a property maybe for generations or at least for a long time and don't necessarily have the income to keep up with the property tax burden that represents. So some greater flexibility to decide things like what South Burlington tried to do, taking advantage of the fact that they have a car rental system there in town related to the airport and an opportunity to raise some revenue from, you know, out-of-town folks visiting the area, take some pressure off the local property taxpayers. Those sorts of alternatives are important for local government, and we need more flexibility there. But perhaps even the greater frustration is just the ways in which the obligation to get permission from Montpelier just makes us slow to react, slower than we wish we were to react to the need to take local action. And as I said, that can even be as basic as just something as simple as changing the regulations related to an on-street parking space where we have to actually adopt ordinances and then publish them for a certain amount of time rather than being able to look at a changing situation on our streets and make a simple change.
That's that classic bureaucratic argument about, you know, red tape. Why do we have to wait for, you know, a decision in Montpelier when all we want to do is, you say, you know, change a parking regulation kind of thing? You know, Peter, that makes sense to me on one level. But let me ask you this. I mean, Vermont is a very small state. And don't very local issues still have the potential to affect the state as a whole because of its size? And I want to bring up something that you just mentioned, which is that vote in South Burlington to have that 0.5% tax on the car rentals because, yeah, that seems like it's a very local thing. But if you have people coming from out of state who potentially are going to visit the Northeast Kingdom or travel to other parts of Vermont, maybe they don't want to pay that extra tax. So maybe that does affect towns outside of South Burlington. Could there be an argument made there for having the state folks in Montpelier look at that and say, yeah, this may not be a great idea?
Yeah, I think that it's important for us on all sides of this issue, as with any issue, to be mindful of the fact that there's no one simple correct answer to something. Public affairs are filled with complicated questions. And as Susan was discussing earlier, it's the importance of the participation in the process and the ways in which decisions get made to be inclusive. That's what leads us to better outcomes. So I think we can acknowledge that in a situation like the rental car, there's a bit more complicated question. But in Bennington, for instance, there was a proposal this year for a charter change that had to do only with the attendance requirements for select board members and I believe also for other board and commission members there in Bennington. And it was not approved by the legislature. And it's hard to imagine something that is potentially having any impact outside of Bennington's borders, coming from that standard that they wished to impose locally.
Was there any reason given for that? Does that often happen for Montpelier? You say, we're not going to approve this charter change because?
It often does happen. I would need to defer to Karen to describe explanations she has heard there in the legislature for why. But it is true. We actually in Brattleboro also had a charter change this year related to allowing 16 and 17-year-olds to vote in local elections that was not yet approved. Our understanding is that one is still going to be considered next January and that there is still the possibility we might have that approved. But again, having the opportunity for youth to participate in Brattleboro's public affairs was a decision that was overwhelmingly approved by Brattleboro's voters, 18 and above. And we weren't asking for that to apply to statewide elections, just to local participation. And it's hard for me to see how there's a negative statewide implication to allowing that to happen here in Brattleboro.
Well, Peter, before I let you go briefly, you have worked in New Jersey and in Florida, as I said before. And I'm wondering if you've seen similar issues there that were resolved and where people were given more of a local direct democracy choice vote, if you will.
I have. And as Karen pointed out, there's quite a spectrum of degrees of home rule and Dillon's rule. Vermont happens to be on the very extreme Dillon's rule side of that spectrum. I have worked actually for a fairly long time in Florida and a brief time in New Jersey in environments that were more home rule oriented. We still had some frustrations in those environments, but, particularly related to some of the more simple, day-to-day, very local kinds of items I was talking about earlier, there was the flexibility for a local government to take local action. I really appreciated Susan's comment that you bring local wisdom and local values to problem solving and you create more enduring solutions because the community that is being affected by something is the group of people deciding how to address it. I've seen that work very well in other places, and I hope that we can gain a greater measure of that here in Vermont.
Peter Elwell is the Brattleboro Town Manager. Peter, thanks so much for the time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, Karen and Susan, you've been listening to Peter and his thoughts there, looking for a little more, direct control and voice, if you will. Karen, let me ask about something that Peter was mentioning there, how he's seen this work in other places, in New Jersey and in Florida. And I'm wondering if the Vermont League of Cities and Towns looks at other places as well and says, these are states where we can do things a little bit better. But, again, Vermont is unique. Is it really comparable to do so?
Well, interestingly, the legislation that passed the Senate this year came from a model that was provided by West Virginia, where they actually did set up this kind of a commission, and they implemented it first, allowing only five cities there to come before the municipal commission. And just this past March, actually, they made that pilot program permanent. And they opened it up to all municipalities, and they said, this is something that allows for innovation and is working, and we're going to make it a feature of the West Virginia government.
So something similar to the pilot project you were just talking about before that the Senate passed here in Vermont.
Yeah, that's really where this proposal came from.
Interesting. We got this comment that was written to us on VPR.org from Mark, who says, why is there always the assumption that if other funding sources are explored, like a rental car tax in South Burlington, that property taxes will go down? Where is the incentive on the part of cities and towns to reduce the total amount of money raised from the property tax? Not sure if either of you want to actually answer that question, but we thought we should get Mark's question put out there for consideration.
Well, I do think that's an important consideration. And one thing to remember is that at town meeting, you vote on your local budget. And so it's the most involvement that a citizen has in the ability to determine what he or she is going to pay in property taxes, but also any other kind of local revenues that are generated at the town level. We have 16 towns with local option sales tax. We have 20 towns with local option rooms and meals taxes, and those have contributed to lower property taxes in some of those communities. So I think municipal officials are very careful about their budgets because they're right in front of their citizens all the time, and citizens have the ability to vote on those budgets.
And those taxes all had to be approved by Montpelier first, right?
Anything that's not a property tax.
Not a property tax. Okay. Let's go to the phones. Carrie is on the line from Marchfield. Hi, Carrie. You're on Vermont Edition.
Yeah, it's absolutely meant to constrain local government. So if they're feeling constrained, that's wonderful. It's working as it should. Because the state government, under Dillon rule, is also supposed to be extremely constrained by the Constitution. And that's getting run over a little bit in our state right now as well. So not only do we have to keep being a strict Dillon rule state, but we have to bring Montpelier back into being more constitutionally focused and honest.
All right, Carrie, thank you very much for the call. She makes an interesting point. You know, these are written into the Vermont Constitution, these rules. This is not something that has been decided in Montpelier willy-nilly, as I understand it. Is that right, Susan Clark?
I'm not an expert on which level, you know, whether how much of this is at the constitutional level versus how much at the state and local, and how much is sort of our ethos, you know, our agreed upon factors. But I will say that, you know, in terms of where the decisions get made, I think trust is a really important issue. And, you know, we just quoted Bernie Sanders. I'll quote Republican Governor Dick Snelling. He once said he trusted the decisions of the Vermont legislature over that of Congress, just as he trusted the decisions of town meetings over the legislature. And he wasn't alone. All our polls show that we trust our national government least, our state government a bit more, and our local government the most. So how we engage with neighbors, that sort of human quality, I think is really, really important to how much we have faith in the outcomes. And right now there are a lot of Vermonters who are frustrated with national inaction on, you know, key issues, things like climate change. And so we're seeing this burst of local energy committees, people who are really interested in turning to local action, because there is no one-size-fits-all solution for climate change. These kinds of things can be dealt with, you know, whether you're on the left or the right. These are things that we can talk to our neighbors about.
Well, it's interesting because things that, like you're talking about, climate change, the environment, human rights, some of the big, big ticket issues, they're not traditionally taken up at the local level for town meeting. They might be discussed. There might be some resolutions passed, but they're always non-binding. I mean, you know, are these things that should be dealt with at a local level? And how much can we really do when we're talking about those big things like climate change?
Well, I want to be really clear that there are some things that are set down by our greater society that can never be left to local control. Some fundamental human rights, things like slavery. We fought a war about that one. That's not a local control issue. Some fundamental human rights, some key environmental protections, things like polluters who are upstream. Just because that river is in my town, I don't get to pollute it, because guess what? There is such a thing as downstream. So, you know, there are some baseline protections that we need to expect. But I see Karen nodding. She's got a...
Yeah, go ahead, Karen. You want to add to that?
Well, I would agree. There are certainly issues that are off the table for local government, and there are issues actually that local governments have absolutely no interest in getting engaged in. And one of the I wanted to speak to your constitutional question for just a moment. It is true that the Constitution in Vermont says that cities and towns are creatures of the state, subdivisions of the state. What we've been trying to do these many years is work within that framework to develop some kind of a construct that lets there be a more balanced partnership between cities and towns and the state. And it's now very unbalanced. And a result of that, I think, is the frustration you hear from people like Peter Elwell, and also the low turnout, generally speaking, at town meetings. You're actually making pretty big decisions for your pocketbook, but there's not a lot of other key decisions that you're making at town meeting anymore. And I think Susan can certainly talk to the issue of what brings people out to exercise their voting rights.
Well, we only have
a few.
Sorry, we only have a few seconds left here, so I'm going to give the last word to Susan. But we did get an email just now from Bill who reflected what you were saying, Karen, about the declining numbers at town meeting. He says he's really seen it decline over the past 30 years, and he thinks that's having a really profound effect on people getting involved in democracy. Susan, last word to you. Is there a future for local control, local decisions being made in Vermont as we move forward?
Well, what you're asking is there a future for democracy? And my answer is, I hope so. I really think that the way that we unpack this question of engagement is people come if they know they can make a difference. People come if their participation matters. And we know this from research, and we also know it in our hearts as we participate as citizens. Empowering local decisions is a way to reinvigorate our republic.
Susan Clark is an educator and co-author of Slow Democracy, Rediscovering Community, Bringing Decision-Making Back. And Susan, thank you so much for the time today.
You bet.
Karen Horn is Director of Public Policy for the Vermont League of Cities and Towns. Karen, thank you so much.
Thank you.